to be able to formally introduce Dr. P. Rama Rao. He's a PhD from the Benaras Hindu University. He is currently the Secretary to Government of India, Department of Science and Technology, and also Secretary to Government of India, Department of Ocean Development. He is also Honorary Professor at the Jawaharlal Nehru Center for Advanced Scientific Research and Visiting Professor of Material Science at Osmania University in Hyderabad. Dr. Rao was earlier Director of the Defense Metallurgical Research Laboratory, Hyderabad. He has also held senior positions at the Benaras Hindu University and Institute of Science, Bangalore. He is a member of several academies, including the Royal Academy of Engineering, UK, the Indian National Science Academy, and the Indian Academy of Sciences, of which he was also Vice President in 1992. Dr. Rama Rao was President of the Indian Institute of Metals and also of the Materials Research Society of India. From 1986 to 1990, he was a member of the Science Advisory Council to the Prime Minister. Dr. Rama Rao has been a recipient of numerous awards, which include the Tata Gold Medal by the Indian Institute of Metals, the National Citizens Award, the Padma Shri, the Homi J. Bhabha Award for Applied Sciences, and the Shanti Swarup Bhatnagar Prize. Dr. Rama Rao is on the editorial board of 6 international and 3 national journals. He has to his credit nearly 200 technical publications and has lectured extensively. May I now invite Dr. Rama Rao to begin his lecture. He will be speaking on science and technology, as you know.
Dr. Ramana and distinguished participants, at the outset, I'd like to express my sincere thanks for the invitation that I've received to talk to you about science and technology. This is too broad a title, and I've had some problem trying to organize a presentation today and tomorrow, which will have some focus at some stage at least. So what I am going to do is to spend today more on bringing you up to date. What is the science and technology system that we have in the country, with some background, how the scientific institutions evolved, and more by way of setting the scene. Tomorrow, in the second half of this, I want to talk to you about where we should be going. At least that's my personal analysis. So we will see some analysis today, because just information is no presentation at all. We'll see some analysis today, but tomorrow I wish to spend on what should be the new approaches. There is a new scenario, and what would be the new approaches where we can attempt a few initiatives with reasonable chance of success, and what would be the kind of mechanisms which may work based on this kind of information which you will see today. Now, it may be of interest for us. In fact, I am trying out this presentation on you in a way. Because, as I said, it's a too large a topic, and so much has happened in the country. And if we write it up, probably there will be some decent summary, which we will attempt. If one of you will assist me, we'll write a summary together. So first thing we can see is how science institutions evolved in this country. Now, if you see the period prior to the independence, the growth of scientific institutions, to say the least, has been sporadic. What do we mean by sporadic? The British established a few institutions more by way of generating surveys. They wanted quite a lot of data about the country, and Survey of India was one of the earliest institutions, probably the oldest scientific institution that we have in the country. They have recently celebrated the 225th anniversary. And if you see most of them, Geological Survey, India Meteorological Department, And these have been survey institutions, and they have survived. These have survived, and even today, I think they are doing yeoman service. In fact, my heart goes out to the scientists who work in these survey organizations, whose work has been taken for granted. Today, if you furnish meteorological information to a television television company, somebody will have to pay for it. But all this is not paid for in this country, and we have to a large extent taken their contributions for granted. That is one aspect of it. There have been other institutions. Now, so then the war in 1939, and then only a bit of attention to what may be called industrial research. Not that it is serious even today, but at least beginning of attention to industrial research after the outbreak of war, and the CSIR was established prior to independence, 1942. Just as Blackett was asked to suggest what should be the kind of defense research we should be embarking upon, there was a scientist, Hill, who was asked what should be the kind of scientific institution building that this country should be getting into. And that's one of the milestones. I'm going to come back to this set of institutional growth, but just you can have this information. So I've also put together some of the other institutions. There's some overlap because one transparency I made some time ago, this one I made now. So there is the overlap, but some more organizations also came along. But I want you to particularly note an initiative like the Asiatic Society. And I'm going to show you how the Western institutions also evolved over a period of time, whether there's a big disparity between the way we have organized our scientific activities and what has happened in the West. The West is, of course, has prospered through technology, but we don't seem to have prospered through technology in a similar way. That question remains to be answered. But I have flagged this Asiatic Society because it's even ahead of the Royal Institution. So we have all of these various institutions prior to the independence. And after independence, it has been certainly better organized. It's not so sporadic, but you will still see that there has been a mushrooming. If we don't want to use the word sporadic, there's been a phenomenal growth of scientific agencies and institutions, and all of them you know. I've just put them together here. So in terms of apex attention to science and technology, we have had all of these bodies right from almost the day of independence, 1948 onwards. We have had an apex committee for science and technology in one form or another. I also have the names of the various people who have chaired these committees. In the beginning, it was Prime Minister, then it was Cabinet Secretary, and then there have been various scientists who have headed these various apex committees. Today, we have Cabinet Committee on Science and Technology. There is also an approval for the formation of Science Advisory Council to the Cabinet Committee on Science and Technology. And there is an empowered group of secretaries which has also been approved. So right from then onwards, we have had this. Now, what have these people accomplished? Somebody may want to know. I have been able to lay hands on one report. I carried all of them just so that if you want to look at this, at least during the interval, and you want to collect them, anyone who is interested. So NISTATS, it's a CSIR organization, they have brought out a compilation of various decisions taken by these apex committees up to a certain point in time. It's not up to date, but at least there has been one attempt to do this. So in terms of policy, as of now, there are only two policy documents. One formally approved by the parliament, and the other which was announced by Mrs. Gandhi as a government document at the Science Congress. So the Scientific Policy Resolution of 1958 is the one which really is a policy document which has gone through the parliament. So technology policy statement 1983 is also a government policy statement. This, as I said, was announced by the Prime Minister then. So these are the only two policy documents we have so far as science and technology is concerned. And SPR is a very, very beautifully worded resolution, scientific policy resolution. I have brought a copy of that. Maybe you can look at the, we'll make some copies of this today. And I would like you to have at least the scientific policy resolution. It's hard to change even a word in that two-page document. And and I want that all those who want to look at SNT in this country must read it at least several times. And there are some very beautiful statements here. Maybe we need not waste our time on this, but I'll give you a copy of that. Some of you might have read this. And so also the technology policy statement, it's not as elegantly written, but it is again a statement from the point of view of how you can use science to go on to technology and how you can use technology for domestic economy. But there are lots of things which have changed. But I thought that you must also take note of the various other policy documents. You cannot look at science policy or a technology policy in isolation. For instance, the industrial policy today, in fact, has a very radical new form, 1991. So we have to look at this technology policy in relation to other policies, trade policy and industry policy, for instance. But there are also other areas like electronics, there's a policy statement. Even ocean development, ocean sciences, there's a policy statement. And it's necessary to look at all of them together so that you have a perspective of what the government has attempted to do, at least till now. So there is an exercise underway to write a new technology policy, and this is something to which all of you also can contribute if you are interested. It is still in the formative stage. The technology policy then, 1983, emphasizes indigenous technology, indigenous R&D. And even if somebody is importing some technology, you have to see whether it is something which is already available in the country. If so, why import? So there's some regulation. And I have done an analysis of what exactly the technology policy statement 1983 aimed at, and what is the new scenario today, how those things are simply not valid anymore. But one feature is that following on the technology announcement of the technology policy statement, there's a technology policy implementation committee which tried to actually go into the details and see whether some institutional mechanisms can be brought into being to attend to the follow-up actions and actually take concrete steps. And a few things have happened. So the Technology Information Forecasting Assessment Council, information forecasting assessment was considered important. So we have an autonomous body, which is now part of the Department of Science and Technology, and we are giving it a new sort of mandate, so to say. And about that, I'll talk tomorrow, because you must hear from me whatever we are trying to do now, and I would value your comments. And a consultancy development center. I wish it had been more effective than what it has been. It's not to criticize CDC, but certainly the advent of consultancy organizations in the country like MECON, EIL, and so on, I think has been very, very important development since independence. And more of that should have happened. And there are lots of areas where we need such consultancy development organizations, especially in engineering design, for instance. Something has happened, but much more needs to happen. The Technology Development Fund, this has not materialized. There is an R&D CESS Act. I think I must refer to that, because that is one source of additional. Although we don't have a Technology Development Fund, this R&D CESS Act has been approved. It is operating. And what this calls for is that anybody who imports technology into the country has to pay a certain fee. This is different from license fee. It's not so much for manufacture, But associated with an activity, a technology related activity, there's a technology which you borrow and they will demand a fee to be paid. So a percentage of the technology fee has to be remitted to the government. That's what the R&D says acts. But this is not available to R&D institutions. That's the point that we have to note. Something like 5% of the technology fee is collected by the government. And this amounts to, so far, I have looked at all the figures, this comes to something like 150 to 160 crores as of date. This is of more recent origin, since 1988. It began slowly, and then now we have an annual collection of somewhere between 40 to 50 crores. And what the government has done is give a part of this to IDBI and organizations of this type, financial institutions, and not all of it. So about 30 to 40 crores out of this 150 crores so far, which has been collected, has been given to these financial institutions. And these financial institutions are giving it in the form of venture capital, which you might have heard about. So this is an area where we have to attack if we have to get more sources for R&D, especially industrial R&D. So when the financial institutions, this is a point I am taking a minute on because this information is not available to several people. It is not for investment in R&D, please note. A financial institution gives to an entrepreneur some money to get going, and he will think of a new venture and he will say that this fellow is supporting me, he is helping me and so on. So it's not so much for R&D, industrial R&D, but new ventures. This is what the financial institutions have done. And I've also tried to assess what is the information that these people have, how in-depth is the technology information that the financial institutions really are able to command in order to take the right decisions. That is also very fuzzy, I must say. But this is what is happening today, that in addition to the plan funds, about which I'll give you an idea, we have this R&D CESS Act, which provides some money from the industry. And it's likely that since the act has not been abolished, it's likely that more and more technology will be imported and more technology fee will be paid, and therefore more and more money will be available. So this is an important point which we have to note. So although the technology development fund, therefore, has not materialized, there is an income coming into the government kitty, is an income being gained by the government from this technology fee. Now, after all this, today, after all these various agencies, today we have so many institutions which are dealing with science and technology labs. There are also in-house R&D units set up by the industry. Large number. There are a number of science and scientific and industrial research organizations which approach the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, DSIR. DSIR has been hived off from DST, old DST. And they are the people who approve or give recognition to an organization as a SIRO so that they can get some tax benefit. There's a number there. But I think one has also to look at these cooperative research associations. These are dedicated to specific areas, textiles, tea, jute, and so on, some examples. Universities, about 200. I'm quite willing to leave behind hard copies of all these so that you have in one place a fair amount of data. So we have more than 1,000, let's say, more than 2,000 R&D institutions. Now all of them put together, according to 1990 statistics of UNESCO, we have about 3.1 million people, stock of manpower. As I said, we are not doing any analysis as yet, but the second half of this, I hope, I'll come to an analysis of all of this, but let's look at this basic information now. So we are about 3.1 million. Wrongly, people say we rank the third largest manpower. Even after the breakup of the Soviet Union, we rank about 10th according to the latest UNESCO statistics. And the money that is being spent, again, I didn't want to load you with too much data. Something like 20 crores, planned plus non-planned, the total expenditure for S&T or R&D. These terms are used rather
without any discipline, I must say. Somebody will say S&T expenditure, R&D expenditure. I have tried to worry what exactly the difference between R&D expenditure, S&T expenditure, and what is the plan outlay, what is expenditure. If you have doubts, if you have questions during the second half, I will answer them. I mean, in the second, after this presentation. So it's something like 8,000 crores up to the 7 plan period. And I'll also give you what is it currently in a minute. The other important point is the total system. For instance, people, visitors who come to the Department of Science and Technology, especially from abroad, expect that when they visit the Department of Science and Technology, they will have all of the information pertaining to science and technology in the country from DST. But actually, our people will give a DST annual report. And this is a big gap. And I feel that a very comprehensive attempt, I came across Science and Technology in Israel. It's an absolutely amazing document. Something like that we'll have to attempt. And I hope before I leave the scene, we'll make some serious attempt to bring out some kind of a compilation, fairly detailed, because it's not so much statistics, it's not so much information. You also have to have some accomplishments and assessment of that. Now, today, as I said, it's not just DST dealing with science and technology. This is something which I want you to appreciate. Now, you can divide, and it's a fairly complex S&T system that we have in the country. That's the reason why coordination also becomes very difficult. Actually, DST was created in 1971 for the purpose of coordination. But you can do no coordination without command and control. Anybody who has worked with defense will appreciate that unless you have command and control, you cannot do coordination. But I have found another technique to do some coordination, and I will talk to you about that tomorrow. Now, you can divide this fairly complex system into two parts, A and B. A is really the significant part. B is not so significant because although you list a number of institutions, you can have a catalog of them, but the amount of S&T that can go on there, practically speaking, is very little. So in B, we can take leave of this very quickly. Science and technology in the states, there is an allocation for that. There is science and technology in the private sector. This also I am saying very little. And there is some science and technology in voluntary organizations. So all of that is one part, which is not so significant. The really significant part, the dominant part, is A. This A has got two parts once again, A1 and A2. A1 is the so-called scientific and S&T departments and agencies. Why do I say so-called? Because everybody expects actually output from these departments and agencies because they have this nomenclature. But there's a lot of science and technology institutions in the other ministries, A2, socio-economic ministries, and we have to appreciate that. So A1 part consists of essentially six departments. The Department of Space, Department of Atomic Energy, the Department of Ocean Development, Department of Science and Technology, CSIR, DSIR. This is the government department, Department of Scientific Research, and the Department of Biotechnology. And there is one more, incidentally. This is what I have told the Home Ministry. We have Forensic Sciences. So Forensic Sciences is placed along with these, and it's in a very pathetic state, and it's another very good discipline where some contribution can be made in a coordinated fashion. S&T can impact on the depth of work in forensic sciences. But these are the S&T departments. We have a whole lot of them in socio-economic ministries, and notably, agriculture figures here. Human resources development figures here. These are the most important ones. And I should circle them. because there's a large allocation. There's also a large accomplishment, especially in agriculture. And I will tell you during the course of this assessment why some institutions have succeeded, why we have not been able to show similar results elsewhere. So environment and forest, petroleum, and Department of Electronics is also part of this. It's not a scientific department. According to this classification, the Ministry of Non-Conventional Energy Sources and Indian Council of Medical Research, and I think agriculture is the one which has really done well, and HRD Ministry supports the university system and the educational system. One of the major recommendations of the SACC, Scientific Advisory Committee to the Cabinet, which preceded the Scientific Advisory Council to the Prime Minister, which was CNR headed. Prior to that, the SACC recommended that there must be science and technology advisory committees or advisory groups in all of these various socio-economic ministries. And so by way of recommendations, or by way of a perfunctory response to these recommendations, we're not really lacking. So this is what you will see. So we have now Science and Technology Advisory Committees. Actually, DST was supposed to interact with all these ministries and get these stacks in place. And this has been done in 20 ministries. Now we have Science and Technology Advisory Committees. And how are they working? That's a different matter. So that is the setup. So the last bit of information which I want to give in this part is the budget. So you saw that something like 8,000 crores. Please leave that aside. Today, the plan allocation, if you see, I have the information up to 8th plan. So you can see that over a period of time, these allocations have been going up. And something like 9,400 crores. But what is important to note is that the Science and Technology Department, the S&T Department Agency, Atomic Energy Space, this is for R&D component, not for reactors, not for building power reactors and so on. But the R&D component of all of these departments account for less than 50% today of the total plan allocation. This is, it was 50% in the last plan period. In the present plan, the allocation to the socio-economic ministries has gone up to 54%. I am not cavilling at that, but this bit of information is really necessary. Actually, that's not enough if you ask me. And I will have something to say on that. How exactly we can make this S&T in so-called socio-economic ministries really tick. Now, is this, so we'll see a bit of assessment of what has happened. I hope this information together gives you a fairly comprehensive set of data to see where we stand. So what has all this accomplished? This money, this complex S&T system, so many institutions, what have they accomplished? So this is a question quite often people ask, especially nowadays. Now, I want to respond to that question in the following way. You cannot answer a question of this kind. It's a sweeping question. What has it accomplished? We don't see much effect, is what people say. So we have to be analytical to answer and to respond to this question. So I have divided all of these various possible areas where you would like to see an impact of science and technology, this investment and this setup which we have, in 6 categories. So let's divide them into 6 parts. You can divide them any other way, but this is what I have done. Basic research, agriculture, strategic fields, scientific services like meteorology, mapping services, and so on, industry, industrial R&D, and societal needs. So when people comment whether S&T has really impacted, they are thinking, politicians especially, political people are thinking of the lifestyle of the common man, maybe in the rural areas and so on. And they would like to see more of the presence of S&T initiatives there. While this is important, why we don't show very good results there is something which we have to ask and answer. So these six parts, and I want to show to you very quickly that in the first four areas we have done well, reasonably well. This is not so much to pat oneself on the back, but we don't have to be too defensive or too despondent. And we have to see where we have done really very well and what has been the input into that, what has been the approach to that, whether similar inputs and similar approaches can be extended to other sectors or other areas, other categories, if you want to see similar results. From that point of view, this analysis is needed. So obviously, we cannot go through all of this in a lecture like this, but very quickly we will see some highlights. So if you consider basic research, the first item which I showed, certainly that's one of the success stories. I say it's one of the success stories not merely because of this kind of statistics. This is the Institute of Scientific Information, Philadelphia, Eugene Garfield. They put out various kinds of analysis, and India ranks among the top 10 in the world in terms of output of research publications. It is not everywhere. They have taken something like 5,000 science citation index, so-called SCI journals, and I've looked at the output from various countries, and India ranks 8th. Today, I find India ranks 10th, but the information which I have put here, India ranks 8th, above Italy and Australia. None of the so-called developing countries figure in that top 10. All the others are industrially leading countries. So we are part of that. So he refers to India as a third world research superpower. But more importantly, I would like to commend to this group and to any audience that this is an area to be proud of. Proud of because there's an ingrained culture. Today, people want us to be internationally competitive. They talk about a global, a global economy, and we have to be competing in the global market. Look at what our researchers do. The culture is ingrained, as I said. So even a young fellow who wants to enter the portals of a leading institute like the Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore, or the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, Bombay, or any of the good universities, good groups, the one aspiration, the one ambition that he entertains is that he must come out with a good publication in a peer-reviewed, internationally reputed journal. So this is the hallmark of international competition, and this is there. Motivations you have to examine. Why is he motivated to do that? Because he gets opportunities thereby. So you have to recognize that we have done well in basic research, and there is an internationally competitive performance here and there. Now, in terms of strategic fields, once again, it's an area of success. And we know today that as long as there is sufficient input of people, money, etc., and support, you can build nuclear reactors, you can build satellites and guided missiles. So we don't have to go into too many details, but you can see that there is demonstrated accomplishment in strategic fields. That is the second category I had. The third category was agriculture. So basic research, strategic areas, agriculture. Now, this is another success story. After all, the country today enjoys food security. But will it sustain? Those are different issues. And even in the case of strategic areas, I have people continuously bombard, saying, tell me what has happened here, what has happened there, this is not happening, that is not happening, and so on. But in an overall perspective, you have to regard them as acceptably success stories. So there is a fourfold increase, nearly a fourfold increase in production. And this is where, in fact, I had a set of slides which I prepared to show, especially in regard to scientific institutions, which we can skip, which you can see a little later on. The point that I had tried to show there was, apart from this simply a summary of how many R&D institutions we have in the country. The important point to note is, any area you take and you want to see how these institutions are dispersed in the country, you will find the map dotted by these institutions. You take electronics, you will have the country dotted by institutions which can give you some competent research support in electronics. Or you take any of the areas like life sciences, once again you will have this. So I have a set of slides for each area, where are the institutions located among the 2,000 odd institutions which we referred to in that summary. Now, the agriculture particularly I want to show, because we are referring to agriculture as some kind of a success story. In fact, there's one area where science and technology has really demonstrated visible results. More can happen, that's a different matter. And one of the reasons why this has happened, apart from the thrust and apart from the basic ability of the farmer to absorb new ideas, this is also something to be recognized. You have these extension centers. You can find fault with them. But I feel the way you have dedicated universities, agriculture universities, you have extension centers, you have an ICAR and so on, all of them put together, particularly the downstream linkages to some extent, however feeble they may be, they are there. And it's a question of something happening somewhere, you know, in that lot, and that's why you see some results. So agriculture, the way the institutions are set up, the way the universities are dedicated to one particular discipline, I think has been an important parameter. The fourth category, scientific services, again I would like to submit, is an area of accomplishment. Now, mapping services, of course you don't get maps easily in the country, that's because of a different reason altogether. But I have been amazed at the work going on. These are dedicated institutions like Survey of India and India Meteorology Department. You can find lots of things which are wrong with them, but there is an output. So you have geological information, you have meteorological information, you have mapping information, you have botanical information, you have zoological information, and so on. And particularly, take for instance the cyclone warning systems. And this we again must underline as a success story coming from science and technology. In 1977, Divi Taluk in Andhra Coast, which is perennially prone to attacks by tidal waves, was hit by one such, and then something like 10,000 people died. In 1990, a similar event of a similar intensity hit an identical location, and only 1,000 people died this time. So an order of magnitude less death in this particular case. And this is clearly because of the India Meteorology Department working in association, in a conjunction with the Department of Space and operating these cyclone warning systems. So you have these four areas. So where have we not succeeded? Although we are able to give examples of high-tech R&D here and there, you can very easily see that some of them, again, we can give lots of examples, but we don't have time for that. Whether you look at the atomic energy, and I particularly like those which are associated with metallurgy, because I can understand them in great deal of depth. Just look at the fuel cladding material for the nuclear fuels. Coming from zircon, you process the mineral, then you make the intermediates, you purify it, you take away hafnium, and hafnium and zirconium have a great deal of affinity. It's not easy, this chemistry of separation. And then you make zircalloy, and then you make a component. And that component is not easy to make once again. You have to control crystallographic texture so the component has the right kind of quality, etc., etc. And so if you look at any one of such accomplishments, it's absolutely mind-boggling how in the face of restrictions and constraints such accomplishments have been made. But does all of that amount to something that we can proudly say we have a high-tech industry in this country? This is exactly what people are looking for when we look at industrial R&D. So the last two categories, industrial R&D and societal R&D, so to say, are the areas which not compare in terms of accomplishments with the first four. So there are pioneering and excellent accomplishments, but it's not a coherent picture. And today, therefore, we have to see how you can improve that picture. And to some extent, the situation has changed. To a large extent, I would say, we are dealing with a new environment, and so industry has to come in a big way. And people are talking about industrial R&D being internationally competitive, or technology being internationally competitive. So you have to transit, just as the economy seems to be transiting from one of protected economy to an open economy. We have to transit from internationally competitive science, which I said we possess, to internationally competitive technology. That transition is what we have to target. Now, this is where a bit of analysis will help about the West. So the question is, if you look at, again, history to some extent, although science and technology seems to have flourished in the West and contributed to economic growth, that revolution has not occurred here. So what is the reason for that? I had some examples of good technology development in the past, present, but we'll skip that. Now, this is where we have to do some analysis. Now, first analysis I want to do is with regard to Western institutions, very quickly. So you look at how the scientific institutions evolved in the West, and you will find that there's not much difference. You look at any country, they'll also have a Department of Atomic Energy, they'll have something equivalent to CSIR, like CSIRO in Australia. Everywhere you'll find some equivalence. But I mentioned to you about the Royal Institution coming subsequent to Asiatic Society. So by and large, you'll find the way scientific institutions developed in the West or here, there's not too much difference, except one area which I have circled, and that is the industrial research. Now, in the West, it's not merely industrial R&D, but there is excellence in industrial R&D. Again, if you want to trace the origins according to one story, the origin of industrial R&D goes back to this discovery of Perkins. He was the first man to develop an industrially useful coal-tar derivative dye. Now, Perkin Elmer, you know. So this discovery converted itself into an industry within a matter of 1 year. And that seems to have sort of given the fillip to industrial R&D. Germany was the country which picked it up. This happened in England. And Germany was the one which said that if the first industrially useful chemical can become an industry, we should be really focusing on such innovations becoming industrial successes. And industrial R&D, corporate R&D, took off from there onwards. But I wanted to give you this observation that we tend to look upon industrial R&D as something which probably relatively not so highbrow, relatively more mundane compared to basic research. I think this mindset also has to be broken. I have also learned it the very hard way. In fact, I must use this opportunity to thank Dr. Ramana, because he was responsible for my switch from Banaras Hindu University to DMRL. And it came as a great deal of education to me to see that you have to do creative research to develop a product, and even an upscale a process. Just look at the way R.B. Subramaniam is struggling to upscale titanium production from a few grams to something like a few tonnage today. There is R&D to be carried out. There's good creative research to be carried out at that kind of point before you have a product which can be industrially accepted or commercially accepted. And you see today people are winning Nobel Prizes. In fact, if you read the story of Langmuir, he had any number of opportunities to do work in a university setup. He deliberately was one man who deliberately opted to work in industry and went on to win the Nobel Prize for surface chemistry. And more recently, for instance, we had this high-temperature superconductivity. IBM won 2 successive Nobel Prizes, IBM Research. And currently, just last year, point of view of creative science is a very respectable research activity. I think this culture is also, and we lack that. So singularly lack that. So if you look at a comparison between the West and the East, now further analysis which I want to give is that although we say we have a large number of S&T manpower, you have to really, because we have to now, we are now focusing on gap areas, not so much gap areas, but we are focusing on category 5 industry, because this is what many people want to see, whether science and technology is contributing to national economy. That's the question people are asking. So if you look at, and Japan, they'll give an example, Japan has done so well, why India is not doing so well. So it's not so much the manpower, it's not so much the money. You have to look at the composition of this manpower. You have to look at the composition of this money as well. So from that point of view, you will find that, first of all, look at, let's look at manpower, for instance. So as I mentioned to you, we have 3.1 million. Let's take one country for comparison. We have data now for now several, but one country for comparison, particularly Japan, because people want us to compare ourselves with Japan. So we have 3 million, they have 13 million. And the population of Japan is 125 million, this is 850 million. So per unit of population, it's much less, a factor of 4 or 5 less. That's one factor. But as I said, you have also to look at the composition. Now, there's a big difference. Just look at the technicians, qualified technicians. We have a large number of artisans. We have to go by the UNESCO definition for a qualified technician. And once again, you'll see the large disparity between Japan and India. Now, we don't even have properly 1 million people in this category. Again, there's a factor of something like 7 or 8 difference between these two, all the populations and the other direction. And even more importantly, how many people are actually engaged in R&D? You want output in R&D. How many people are actually engaged in R&D out of this total stock of S&T manpower? Not even 1 lakh properly. Just about 100,000. So if you want more R&D, if you want more output, obviously we have to change this. The other important fact is that how many of these people are actually engineers and technologists? You will find, again, if you look at the annual turnover of scientists and engineers in our country and compare this with Japan, there is an inversion. And please do not think that this has happened by accident. You have to read people like Subiro Okita, who was responsible for doubling the Japanese economy in the 60s, just in one decade. If you read that document, it's extremely educative and instructive. It was by deliberate policy that they wanted more engineers and technologists. And even today, the situation is like this. So if you want more industrial R&D, technology, scientists are valuable, but you have to change this composition. Pay some attention to that. That's one aspect. I have some comments to make on that, but I'll come back to that maybe when you ask some questions. Now, we'll look at the other important input for R&D. Again, for industrial R&D, we're now tackling that question. So you have seen the manpower situation from the point of view of that issue. Now, you look at the expenditure. We are talking about something like 8,000 crores in all for the planned period. Please, again, you have to be clear with these numbers, and I'll clarify the point for you. When you say R&D expenditure, this figures which I am now having here is annual R&D expenditure. So there's figures come for planned period, figures come from annuals and so on. But just look at this annual R&D expenditure. When you talk about expenditure annually, it is all of it put together, including defense. Incidentally, among our S&T system there, defense is outside S&T agencies, outside socio-economic ministries, because defense funds come from non-plan. The division planning commission makes is only because of their allocations. But this R&D expenditure takes into account all of that expenditure, including non-plan, that is maintenance and people. So if you look at that, we are spending about $2 billion at current rate of exchange, approximately. In fact, the easiest way to remember is the world spends something like $500 billion today, currently, annually, and India spends $2 billion on R&D, which is just about 0.4% of the world R&D. See, you can say that our expenses are lower and so on. Those things are okay, but this information is very important for us. The developed countries account for something like 96% of the total world R&D. And out of the 4% by the developing countries, we don't even account for 10% of that, if you really look into the detail. So I have argued this point very vigorously with the Planning Commission, some success here and there. But it's very important to note that we are not 0.4% of the world by any other yardstick you can take. So it's not as if we are spending a hell of a lot of money on R&D. How exactly we are using this money is a different matter. There we are accountable. But if you want results, inputs are important. We can make the machine more efficient. We are willing to do that. But what are the inputs? So the two basic inputs are manpower and you see the disparity. I wanted you to see the disparity. And I saw some kind of a pseudo correlation between we want to push up trade. Our trade is not also very considerable. Please remember that. That all this growth in export market and so on is just about allowing us to reach something like $20 billion. And $20 billion accounts for something like 0.4% of the world trade. So that 0.4%, this 0.4% clicked in my mind. So we have a 0.4% share in the world trade and we are also spending 0.4% of world R&D in terms of R&D expenditure. Please do not think that there's a one-to-one correspondence. In fact, I try to make a plot. You see some correlation, but this again requires analysis because, but you see, if you want to push up our share in world trade, there's just no way of accomplishing that unless we also improve our expenditure in R&D. Improve our manpower. You can't do with 100,000 people. You have to double it probably very soon and so on. So that those basic ingredients, you cannot make compromises on. So I have done that much. Here and there, you can do some more analysis. Are engineers really that important, one can say, you know? Scientists also can do industrial R&D. So I try to see what is the situation with regard to CSIR and DRDO. Now, some organizations don't give information. Fortunately, because I work for DRDO, I'm able to get information. You see that the proportion of engineers to scientists in CSIR is a little more than, if you say science versus engineering, a little more than 2:1. Whereas it is the other way. So far as DRDO is concerned, DRDO has other techniques. Let's not underestimate the value of those techniques. But at least in terms of the number of engineers and people with technology degree, there is once again some difference. Now, how can we increase? Let me cover that point as well since we have talked about manpower. How can we increase the proportion of engineers or technologists? If we want more industrial R&D to come, how can we do that? Should we set up new institutions, etc., etc.? So just as we are asking questions about productivity of our R&D, we must also look at productivity of our institutions which are producing engineers and technologists. So it was an interesting analysis. I have not done this, but a man called Gelote has done this analysis. And I took it from his article. You can see that if you compare the productivity of our IITs with the productivity of similar institutions, leading institutions in US, because IITs are leading here, you can take some top universities in the US, the number of graduates versus the faculty which you have, if that is the productivity ratio, is just about 1.25. That's the reason why many of the IIT professors don't have much teaching load, actually, if you really ask them questions. Now, whereas this is significantly higher in the Western countries, especially US, and the student to faculty ratio, if you see, again, it's double, even in a country like US. The more students to a faculty member, twice as many. So the easiest way to do is to improve the productivity. At least quickly you will see more engineers and technologists come. I think that needs to be examined, and it's worthwhile examining. And it's not really impossible. If you're really in a crunch, we should be doing some of these things to improve the situation. Now, may I stop here so that I'll see what exactly you want to ask me, and then we can look at various mechanisms. But if I can take 5 more minutes, instead of talking about new approaches, I will talk about even in terms of initiatives that have been taken in the recent past exactly to improve our performance from the point of view of S&T output. And one such initiative is technology missions. Certainly, it's an initiative which has to be respected because it has shown some results. So it's not as if country has never attempted to crack this machine to better performance. And one area where you can say something nice has happened is technology missions, especially if you want to look at something like oil seeds. So we can show oil seeds as an example of success of technology missions, where S&T system has been harnessed with new strategies from the point of view of management of this S&T system. And you will find that now today, practically the import of oil seeds is negligible. So this is when we were spending thousands of crores, we don't have to spend thousands of crores on import. So what are the sectors that we must be similarly attempting? What should be the approaches? Is something which we can discuss as we go along. And I had more to give here in terms of why defense succeeded, why this succeeded, and so on. But I think we can answer questions as we go along. First of all, let me say, I've enjoyed my coming here. And I decided last evening to stay back rather than accept a dinner invitation from a friend so that I can spend more time in the company of the participants. And also somebody said to get silence in a hotel, it must be the most expensive place. To get quiet in a place is also the most difficult thing. And decided to savor this quiet ambiance of NIAS. So I will go through a bit more rapidly today, because what is important is not so much to explain or look into the details, but to convey to you some perspective. But the focus is going to be on technology. So I have tried to divide this presentation broadly into 3 sections. How we are going to promote technology development in this country, because we saw that the first 4 areas are reasonably in hand, and what is important is to find ways and means of managing technology in such a way that there is an impact on economic growth. That is the key issue. So let's see what we can do. Not that we have all the solutions, but a few examples of what we may be attempting. We have circulated the technology policy statement. I'm not going to discuss that. But you can see in the old technology policy statement, the basic objectives were indigenous technology development. And if you're going to import technology, the emphasis was on absorption of this and adaptation. During the question time yesterday, we discussed all these issues about repetitive technology, etc., etc., etc. But you know that there has been a new statement on industrial policy, 1991, that has radically changed the scene. And what are the essential differences between technology matters then and now in this new context? So briefly, I have put down some kind of a comparison. We were selective in terms of technology imports. Now it's relaxation, relaxed regulatory regime. So earlier it was emphasis on no-why and unpackaging absorption. There's no such emphasis now. And we wanted to evaluate, assess. If you read that document, it's been circulated. Now all this is going to be determined by market forces and so on. So the new environment, in fact, automatic approvals for something about 51%, etc. I'm willing to leave behind all these transparencies. So all that you have to do is to get a glimpse of these so that we can cover more ground. Now, what is the situation today? How much of technology has really come from indigenous R&D? And that's a question somebody would like to answer. But let me tell you, whatever figures I've been able to gather, it doesn't mean that they're very authentic. It's the most difficult thing I find to get at numbers. So, but some ballpark figures, so don't take them as most accurate. Now, we said there are something like 1,200 in-house R&D units. They have not done badly at all. Industrial R&D units, yesterday I gave a summary about the infrastructure. And among them, we said there are 1,200 in-house. In-house means industry R&D units. And they spend about 1,000 crores, not too much. And the total R&D expenditure, this component is also included. We saw in the course of the discussion yesterday that if we want to get more technologies in this country, and especially directed towards industrialization or commercialization, industry will have to invest more and more. We saw a comparison between the West, Japan, and especially Japan and India. So that we reserved for discussion. I'm today also going to do the same. And as we go along, if I find that I've overloaded you with too much information, we'll reserve for some of it for discussion. But please see that if they invest 1,000 crores, they're getting a turnover of something like 12,000 crores. But somebody argued and said it's 25,000 crores. So it could be anywhere between 12 and 1,000 crores, which is not too bad an output. That if we invest X amount of money in R&D, you're going to get 10X or 12X or 25X. That index is very important. How effective this R&D injection into industrial processes is a very important index. Same way we have to assess our R&D inputs from national labs. And it's 3,000 crores. I have tried to see as much as possible. CSIR has some claims that so much of R&D, their R&D has gone into industry and so much annual turnover, etc., etc. But I think 3,000 crores from indigenous R&D, from our labs, DRDO, all put together, something like 3,000 crores. It could be 5,000 crores, but it can't be very much different. So here the index is rather low. This index is somewhat better, even as it is. But the totality of it does not amount to much. So if you look at the total industrial production in the country, and if you have a figure, then you'll find that contemporary industrial production, I mean, industrial production as a result of our contemporary R&D or some contemporary technology does not account for more than 4 to 5% in the country's total, this. Much of it is dated. Much of industrial production today in the country is actually dated, technology-wise. Something which has been imported, then modified, etc., etc. But quite often it's... So 95% is something which we have accepted as the only thing that we can possibly do. This situation has to improve. That is the focus today. How are we going to contribute to better technology development and benefits from it? Now, what is the reason why this has not been so effective so far? Lots of reasons. It's a bit heavy, and that is, I have taken this essentially from what Dr. Varadarajan says. He also makes lots of presentations, And he, in fact, he gives so much information, it's very difficult to cull out from what he's trying to say. But I have put down a few constraints from discussions with him, essentially, but also my own perception. You can see that late start and lack of foreign investment also is what people say. So much of it you also know, much of it you also know. And the driving force has not been there. Let's put it that way. I think it has been a protected economy, and as I showed you yesterday, in fact, I have tried to look at all kinds of transitions from the situation then and the situation now, but the central point there is also related to going from protection economy to global economy. So as long as you are doing functioning in a protected economy, you don't worry about cost, you don't worry about quality. And all this has to change, and all this will make a demand on S&T system. So I am very clear, at least this is debatable, but at least in my mind I am very clear that willy-nilly people will have to draw from indigenous R&D. Now, as I mentioned to you yesterday in the course of the discussion, there is one silver lining. Have we not done any part of industry, have we not done well at all? So the silver lining, as I was telling you yesterday, during the course of discussion, is in the field of drugs and pharmaceuticals. Going from 10 crores, I suppose I didn't write 10 million, going from 10 crores to something like 6,000 crores turnover, and this also we have discussed, how much of it is new molecules, etc. This also we have discussed, but I would like to put it down as one success in the industrial scene. Yesterday we saw that we have done well in the first four categories, reasonably well. And the industry is really bad. Society related is also not so clear. These are the two areas. I'm not going to discuss too much about society, except I want to make some remarks towards the end. So the if you look at that industry section, the fifth category which we mentioned, we have not done so well. One silver lining is in this field. And this you can see in terms, after all, the bottom line is in terms of turnovers, profits, exports. And all those figures we have today, and they're quite gratifying. Now, I want to go back for a minute. We said that two ingredients are essential. You must have them in enough. The one is input of money. The other is input of people. And we saw that we have these numbers in the country, it's various documentation. But what is necessary is to look at the composition. Composition of the people, composition of money. That also I'm glad we had a chance to discuss in the course of the discussion. If you say $2 billion, where is this money going? How much of it is really going for R&D? These issues are very important. But overall, these two issues are critical. And unless this is there, you cannot see results. You can make the machine more efficient. That's a different matter. It could be inefficient and you can make it more efficient. So this I am very clear, comes through in all the sectors wherever we have tried to do, tried to show some positive results. Now, just to prove the point, to be scientific, you can see that we have said strategic areas in agriculture we have done well. Now you can see that of the 6,000 crores, nearly 40% goes into these sectors. Plus minus. And so there has been an investment of funding in that. So if you don't see results in some other area, you must ask these basic questions in particular fields, not in generality. And I also mentioned to you about engineers, and I'll put it back again, scientists versus engineers. I find that this is also an important thing, and I have some comparison with CSR versus RDO. I was also very pleased to look at an institution like CWPRS. I do not know how many people are aware of this institution. 72% of CWPRS staff, this is Center Water Power Research Station in Pune, they do only project work. It came as a revelation to me that while CSR is only today talking about 30% sponsored work, and again we have to look at the composition of what is the 30% income from external sources, much of it is from the government. But look at an institution like CWPRS, most of their income, or 60% of their non-plan requirement comes from their work on projects. And again, this is related to the way they are set up. And I would like to sort of underline this point about 75% of them being engineers. I don't know, maybe I'm overemphasizing this point, but certainly the balance is very important. Unless you have more technicians and you have more qualified technicians, today Japan is talking about super technicians and so on. So you have to be in that mode, very clear about what is that you want to see at the output point. Now, drugs, once again, is not bad. See, I want to make a small comparison of what is the total outlay for a particular sector and how much of, what is the percentage of the, what is the amount that is given for R&D or deployed for R&D as a percentage of that outlay. So I, you can see that if you say atomic energy, then something like that is their outlay, and you see the figure for the S&T component, 10% is for, let us say, S&T. As I told you, S&T, R&D, let's consider them as synonymous. If you take defense, it is something like 5%. Please note this 5% is very important. In fact, I made one observation yesterday. That is, you can divide all these this complex system into two parts, A and B. And A, we divide it further into A1 and A2. But there is one C, that is DRDO, because their money comes from non-plan. And their money comes as a percentage of the defense outlay. Please note this. This is a very important factor. The DRDO money comes as a percentage. So when people say not enough money, not enough money, then the government can take a decision. So I was physically present in the gallery that day when PM announced this year, last year budget time, because after the consultative committee, I'm sure a lot of discussion, he said, I'm raising it from 4% to 5%. Now, it's something which I want to focus your attention on, because this kind of statement is not there in other sectors. There is no socio-economic sector in which, there's no socio-economic sector, take it from me, in which the R&D money or the S&T money is allocated as a percentage of the total outlay. That itself clearly points out the loss of perspective. This is a very good thing we have, 5%. So they get 1,000 crores. If this goes to 30,000 crores, this will go to 1,500 crores and so on. That's a very important point. Now, in pharmaceuticals also, it's not so bad, drugs and pharmaceuticals. So you see some result. Health and family planning, again, is one of the better ones. Considering all of them are socio-economic, it's 2%. But look at the situation in other sectors. Take, for instance, railways. Yesterday, I promised there's one person here from railways. Yeah. So I told him that one word about railways. The total outlay is something like 27,000 crores. Maybe it has gone up to 40,000 crores. I don't know. I have to look at the latest figures. 27,000 crores. And what is the S&T component? It's 25 crores. 0.1%. And I'm told in the latest 93-94, it's even gone down to figures less than 0.1. This is the nub of the problem. So if you want to have a radical, it is not CSIR, it is not the socio-economic ministry, S&T ministry, all this. So the central point is that if you want to grow a particular sector by way of new technology inputs, by way of R&D related technology inputs, these outlays have to be discussed in terms of percentages of the total outlay. After all, you can only the total outlay cannot be changed because the country has only so much money. But how much of that you are willing to apportion for R&D related, technology related activity, I think is one key issue. And this is what I am saying. You can discuss this during the discussion time if you like. This is not done. Now, so I'm going to spend some time on some new approaches. This is partly what we have been trying to do, because you have to get some flavor of you have asked me to come, so you want to get some flavor of what I've, not so much to publicize what we are doing, but I can only talk about what initiatives we have attempted and what seems to be gelling. See, DST is actually only playing a catalytic role. So, one area, and as I was mentioning before the Parliament Committee the other day, that I, for instance, I have a personal mission. Every person who goes to a particular department or an institution has to have a mission of his own. So this is my personal mission. That is that we will work with other departments. We may not have command and control situation, but I have to find ways of working with the other departments because I see no other way of generating some synergistic results. You have X amount of money, that is inadequate. You can go on shouting from housetops that X must be 2X, 3X, 4X. DST can say, you raise my budget. To some extent, they will raise. But it's not going to be 10X in any case. But it can be 10X or 20X if we get access to the inputs of other departments. So one area of success is the interaction with the Department of Food. Success in the sense, at least we have launched this activity. So this is... one I'm going to mention. Another, of course, is working with DRDO. These two examples I want to give. Both are departments outside DST, so to say, and working together. So this coordination which we were talking about yesterday in the discussion can only come through ideas. You cannot simply say that one department should coordinate with another. This is not just viable unless you have an idea. So the key to coordination in the situation, the structure that we are operating, is good projects, good ideas, and I'm sure they will be received well, provided the approach is also with a viewpoint of assisting the socio-economic ministry. And we mentioned about technology mission. This was also one idea. I'm sorry, I should go. I think I'll not talk about technology mission and oil seeds. Yesterday we mentioned that. So let's stay with this. So the one kind of approach is government to catalyze an interaction between these. That is, DST will catalyze, let's say, the S&T system, socio-economic ministry and industry coming together. And I mentioned in that respect, the example that we have just now said is this. So what is the work that we have taken up? Sugar. Incidentally, I'm also going to give some figures about where India has done well. And sugar certainly is one area. India is the single largest producer of raw sugar in the world. But that does not mean that the industry is high tech. It does not mean that the industry is very efficient. So there is large room. Already you have an infrastructure of an industry. So the goal is for, even with our limited budget, as you can see. So we went and offered a package for which we said we will invest. So there are lots of industries, 400 odd industries, and some I have visited. Now, the Department of Food has what is known as a sugar development fund. And they also get it as part of the contribution from the industry. I'm not part, CESS, sugar CESS. They get about annually something like 210 crores. Today they're using it to give loans for expansion, this modernization, so-called expansion, so-called modernization and so on. But the amount of technology sensitivity there is not very high. So we said it is that which we will try to bring in. And so we have a program now of improving the productivity. And once again, as I mentioned to you yesterday, the goal has to be clearly set. So the goal is here to increase efficiency and so on, and to go up from 13 million tons to 20 million tons. That's the goal. You don't have to increase the number of industries. And make it more productive, reduce the cost, and also improve the export earnings. Some figures by discussion with, so a lot of legwork has gone into it, and a lot of lobbying has gone into it to carry conviction with them, because they think that scientists only talk, they don't perform. There is a certain hiatus, and this has to be bridged, and this can be bridged through hard work. And I feel very gratified that this is now on. Now, we have to have a project management approach. And I will make a general statement, a sweeping statement maybe, that is that the idea of how a project has to be managed is still not widely appreciated. And this is also one of the flaws. This we saw to some extent in the discussion yesterday. So if you want to have a project like this going, it is very clear that you need flexibility. So we located this project in the autonomous institution we have, TIFAC. That's the only thing that we can do, because DST is a government department. If we have to recruit somebody, a whole lot of procedure. And even if you find that this fellow is a fine fellow, you can't recruit him. You can't get him on a contract job easily. So we located this because clearly knowing that flexibility is needed, we located in this. And of course, people will criticize. There's no doubt about it. They will say TIFAC, Technology Information Forecasting Assessment, was set up for some other purpose. These guys are doing something else. That's what they will say. But it does not matter as long as what we are doing. We are very clear about what we are doing. Now, and also I felt that people have asked the question, you generate information, you generate assessment reports, what next? So I think it will answer at least that criticism, but it gives us flexibility because it's an autonomous institution. So we have located a project director. That also took some time. And this project director was acceptable to the Department of Food. That is the key to our success. And then all this has been approved by Planning Commission and Finance. And I made the proposal that the Secretary of Food will be the chairman of a steering committee to look at how all this is going to go on. So the point is that the DST secretary who initiated all of this activity goes into the background. I find this also very important for success. Okay? Because who has to show results? The sugar industry has to show results. The Ministry of Food has to show results. And we have to facilitate that. So we are not the dominant partner, but we are facilitating partner. So I was very happy that the Minister for Food made one public statement that they have launched a big project with the Department of Science and Technology. So that's just aside. The important thing is, out of the foreign industries, you have to make a selection. Which industries will absorb new technology inputs? Again, the details we'll skip. I have got, if somebody is interested, we have listed the various technology inputs that are possible and how to improve the processes and the productivity essentially. The productivity also is average about 8 to 9%. Today, we want to push it up to 11% average everywhere. So like that, we have put some targets and we have some idea of what is to be done in all of these. And then you have to select industries. So this also was not an easy exercise. It took 6 months of interaction, because if the recipient industry is not really motivated, it's not going to be a success, because this is actually a loan amount. So all of this exercise has been gone. We have now 20. We wanted to select 30, but we said that the initial effort must show success, at least in the course of the next 6 months to 9 months. We must show some good results. So we picked 20 as a result of interaction, for which questionnaires were distributed. All this was analyzed, and we made the Department of Food select. So they are the engine of this sort of whole program. I mean, so I've taken some time to describe that. So this is the way to go about, I feel. Suppose if railways want to do something like that, there's a model there. If suppose coal wants to do something like that, there's a model there. We can't be helping everybody, but it's important that the ministries themselves are receptive. So we struck some oil, let's say, with the Department of Food. Now, DRDO was relatively easy. Dr. Kalam and I have been working together, and he's one of the most positive persons, as you know. And we have decided one advanced material. So I was trying to look for various things, and again we had some indices, which areas to pick. And finally, the area to pick will also be dependent upon who is going to drive it and who is the key person, like the project director. Do you have the right man? So even though the project may have very clear objectives and goals, the persons also are very important. So this is the idea, is to use the defense capability to promote the use of advanced composites in components and so on in various industries in the civilian market. And again, a very large potential, very large potential. Just putting composites in railways is going to be a very large thing. But then you have to demonstrate that. And again, it's a joint program with investments from both, and again with blessings from both Planning Commission and Finance. So that is one thing I want to, so those two examples I've given. And just to give you one example, just take the windmill blades. The Ministry of Non-Conventional Energy Sources, this is another ministry, another socio-economic ministry. So we have brought this not as part of the composites mission, but because of all of this exercise, once again we are able to carry conviction with the then Secretary MNES, Mr. Venkateshan, who is Secretary of Expenditure today, to give the project to DRDO. They were not even aware that DRDO has, for instance, a center, Comprac, a center like Comprac, which has major facilities for composites development. And it's a very expensive thing, and design components involved. So I said, if DST can put money for design exercises, we'll put some money. But we'll make use of this. Now the allocation has gone to this Comprac project. The project has been, this has been given to DRDO project and also to HAL. There's some competition there. But you can see, just one component, if they want to make 5,500 megawatt windmills, 2,000 units, 5,000 blades, it's in excess of 2,000 crores. Just one product. So DRDO is capable of executing it, provided their product is accepted. But that's the kind of potential that exists in terms of some of these new materials. Now, so you can see, once again, we have brought in MNES. So I found that by and large, and I find that you don't have to, I mean, I'm not decrying anybody, I mean, or higher up or anybody. As long as two or three secretaries, there is enough power vested in them, are willing to work together, one can go ahead. That is another message that comes through. But then we have to put in a lot of effort there. And there's one more example with Ministry of Welfare, which I happen to come across by accident, that the Ministry of Welfare has a fair amount of money. During Rajiv Gandhi time, he gave a major project for developing items for physically handicapped. And there was some kind of a monitoring setup. So they said I should monitor. So I sat in the monitoring exercise and found that most of their projects, again, were open-ended, although the mandate was application. That means whatever is already developed, they have to apply to produce a product. But then they were saying which industry, etc., etc. But then they were willing to go along with us. And this, now again, I went back to Dr. Kalam because this involved use of composites. And so now we have a project with DST, DRDO, and Ministry of Welfare. So I'm very happy about some of this, and so I'm taking this opportunity to put it across. And there's much that can come. And this is for the physically handicapped. This is polio patients, and the product is what is known as FRO, flow reaction orthosis tool. And now a lot of objections from Alimco. You see, Alimco is a production agency. In the public sector, the Ministry of Welfare, and they have a large inventory of metallic calipers. The one that is made by composites, although it's a new material, reduces the weight by a factor of 4 to 5, and then reduces the cost also by a factor of 3. One case where you reduce the cost as well. And then the comfort. So the interaction with the hospital, Nizam Institute of Medical Sciences, and once Dr. Kalam came on the scene, he's a wizard in this kind of a thing, and it simply expanded like nobody's business. And we have gone on to register a biomedical society, and they have expanded this concept to other gadgets. And recently Dr. Kalam gave a very fine presentation at the Science Congress as to how some of these defense technologies which are used in various systems can be used for biomedical applications. So let's see how this grows in the time to come. But I have an important analysis here. Whether it's defense to civil or whatever, what I want to convey is that if you want to transfer expertise, it can only be done through people. You cannot write documents. People can't read documents. And you don't get the feel for what you read. It has to be done through people. So if you want to transfer some of these techniques, strategies, you have to transfer people from one place to another. So not only they learn, like the way I have learned many things as I moved, but they all, you can also, today for instance, we have a man like Rajan in Department of Science and Technology, he came from space. So he brings in a new flavor of experience, which today is very valuable in the present context. So I think it's very important. So I made a small analysis of what can you get if you move a person from defense to civil. It's not so much defense to civil, but somebody who has done very good project management work. Please do not underestimate this project management. And I have seen any number of presentations in the last nearly 3 years in DST, and I can tell you